From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, comic and actor Aziz Ansari. He has a new comedy special that he's making available exclusively on his website. He co-stars in Parks and Recreation, and in the past year he had a cameo in a Jay-Z and Kanye West music video. He says his friends from the rap world respect his self-deprecating humor, even though self-deprecation isn't exactly a big part of rap.
In a rap song, you want to live vicariously through them. You want to be on the jet or whatever. You want to be like, and then I drove my mom's car because I can't afford my own.
Also, we get a rare interview with Doris Day.
It had to be you.
Doris Day turns 88 tomorrow, and in celebration, she's TCM's Star of the Month. We'll talk about how she started singing and making movies and why she left Hollywood. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
Finally found.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comic and actor Aziz Ansari. He co-stars in the NBC series Parks and Recreation as Tom Haverford and has been in the films Get Him to the Greek, Funny People, and Observe and Report. Aziz Ansari has a new comedy special. His previous special was on Comedy Central, but this time he's taking his cue from his friend Louis C.K. and making the special available exclusively on his website for download and streaming for a nominal fee. It looks like this is becoming a trend for comics who want to bypass the networks and go directly to their fans. Let's start with an excerpt of Ansari's new comedy special called Dangerously Delicious. It's a live performance from the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. This part is about ethnic slurs. Ansari is of Indian descent and grew up in South Carolina. He often talks about race and ethnicity in his act.
One day, I decided to do some research on racial slurs and see if I could learn anything. And I found a very interesting article. It was titled List of Every Ethnic Slur. And it was 21 pages long. And I read all of them. And if it's cool with you guys, I'd now like to share a few of my favorites. Now, these are racial slurs, ethnic slurs, okay? So they're offensive. They're offensive by their very nature. So if I say one or I describe one and you're offended, there's no reason to be like, oh, because we all know they're offensive. So instead, you can shut your mouth. At the same time, though, I don't want to do this bit and look at the audience and see some guy just like, yeah! Because that would be terrifying on the other end of the spectrum. So here we go, my favorite racial slurs, okay? The first one, it's defined as a derogatory descriptive phrase for a person of predominantly Caucasian ancestry with real or suspected distant Asian or African ancestry. Now, this is a pretty specific situation to need to bust out a racial slur, but if you're ever caught in a jam, all you gotta say is, you know what, man? You got a touch of the tar brush. Yeah, you heard me. You got a touch of the tar brush. This is a tar brush. This is you. You don't think I see that distant Asian ancestry in your predominantly Caucasian face?
It's Aziz Ansari from his new comedy special, Dangerously Delicious. Aziz, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to talk with you again.
So, thank you so much for having me.
One of the things you talk about on your comedy special that's on your website, Dangerously Delicious, is about how you're still single and you're still having problems dating even though you're on TV and friends say to you, you're on TV, you shouldn't have any trouble. And you do this whole, what am I supposed to do? Go into a bar and say, excuse me, I'm a guy on TV. And expect people, you know, that are just going to come up to you and like volunteer. But has it changed your dateability to be a recognizable TV person?
Obviously, you know, people come up to me because they recognize stuff I've done. You know, there's no denying that. But my point in that bit was that it's not this, like, dream situation people kind of imagine in their heads. There's a lot of just, like, random dudes that are like, oh, man, it's that brown guy that's on that thing. You know, like, there's that, too, you know. But, of course, you know, there's women that come up to me and say, oh, you know, I enjoy your work, and I've met a lot of interesting people that way, and I'm fine with it. It's so interesting because people ask about that stuff, and they're like, "Don't you think those girls are just coming up to you because you're on TV and you're a comedian?" It's like, yeah, I know that, but no one ever asks like some like good looking stud dude like, don't you think those girls are just coming up to you because of your face? Like, it's just that's not looked at as a negative. And it's like, Right. Well, to me, that's worse because that guy did nothing to earn his face. He didn't, like, sculpt his nose. Like, I worked really hard and developed this career and put out a body of work. So if someone's a fan of that and they came up to me because of that, that's less shallow than going up to someone because you like their face or their sweater or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, the guy didn't make the sweater. He just bought it, you know? And so I think there's kind of this thing of, like, saying, like, oh, going up to someone because you like their work and meeting someone that way is, like, a shallow thing. But sometimes you meet people that are, like, super interesting that are just like, oh, I saw your thing. I enjoyed it. And then you start talking and you're like, oh, you're an interesting person. I enjoy your company. And I've made friends that way, you know?
It's funny because, like, your character on Parks and Recreation is so confident that he's, like, you know, cooler than anybody else. But in your stand-up comedy specials, a lot of your comedy is based on self-deprecating humor and on being single, about the difficulty of, like, you know, finding a woman, not only finding the right woman, but, like, finding somebody, you know, like, asking somebody for a date. And it's, like, two different sides of you, like, the overconfident thing that you play and the underconfident self that you play.
Yeah.
So which is closer to the real you, the underconfident one?
I don't know. I kind of play up that underconfidence in the stand-up a little bit. I'm probably somewhere in the middle. Like, I'm pretty confident in myself in a lot of ways. But, you know, what guy doesn't see, like, a beautiful woman and might be a little bit nervous to go up to her, you know? I think most guys would say they've been in that situation, you know? I think, you know, you want to be relatable. And, you know, it with stand-up, it's more interesting to hear about people's failures than their successes, I think, sometimes. Like, you don't want to hear a story about, like, oh, and then I went up to this hot girl and everything worked out fantastic. We're dating. Everything's great. Good night.
She thinks I'm real handsome. She thinks, like, I'm hot. Thank you for coming.
People would be like, I hate that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's much more endearing to hear about someone going through the same struggles we've all gone through.
So your humor on stage is self-deprecating. And I'm thinking, like, you're good friends with, like, you know, or good friends, I don't know, but you're friends with Jay-Z, you love hip-hop, and, you know, the hip-hop is so much about confidence and swagger and feeling like you can go up to that beautiful woman and she's going to be really happy that you went up to her, because you're the best when it comes to making love or standing up to the cops or looking good or, you know, whatever needs to be done. And I'm wondering, like, how your self-deprecating humor goes over with your hip-hop friends, because the sensibility in some ways seems pretty different.
Well, being a rapper is, like, about being cool and things like that. And being a comedian, you're not really supposed to be the coolest guy. So I think, you know, they understand it's a different type of thing, you know? And, you know, those guys are super funny. They have a really great sense of humor, and when I do hang out with them, like, we'll laugh hard at things we all say, and they have a great sense of humor, so they understand it's a different thing. I don't think they're like, oh, man, Z's isn't cool. You know what I mean? It's just a different thing to be a comedian. There's not a self-deprecating rapper. That wouldn't work. If you were a rapper that was like, I saw this girl, but I was too scared. like, that doesn't work for a rapper. You can't be like, and then I took her back to my place, and she said she had a boyfriend. Like, that rapper wouldn't go very far. Because in a rap song, you want to live vicariously through them. You want to be on the jet or whatever. You want to be like, you know, and then I drove my mom's car because I can't afford my own. Terry, I think we got to do a self-deprecating rapper album. Do you make beats on the side?
Absolutely. That is what I do in the evenings.
Or maybe you could sing the hooks.
I do that too. It's really funny. You should bring it up. Absolutely.
I can't afford a car.
My guest is comic and actor Aziz Ansari. He co-stars in Parks and Recreation and has a new comedy special available exclusively on his website. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Aziz Ansari. He has a new stand-up comedy special that he's making available as a download or streaming on his website only. And he's also one of the stars of Parks and Recreation. Now, on Parks and Recreation, you play Tom Haverford, who works with Parks and Recreation Office. Why don't you describe your character?
I play a low-level government administrator that works at this Parks and Recreation Department, and kind of the character story is that he grew up in this small town, and he lives in this small town in Indiana, and he really wishes he was kind of this impresario like, you know, Russell Simmons or Sean P. Diddy Combs or, you know, one of these guys that just has his fingers in a lot of pies and is this big mogul. But he's in this really small town. He's too scared to go to, like, New York or L.A. to kind of really make that happen. So he kind of tries to live those dreams in the confines of this very small town. And I love working on the show, and everyone in the cast and everybody is just fantastic.
Well, actually, you know, he leaves Parks and Recreation for a while to start a media marketing business called Entertainment 720. Make those mogul
yes.
dreams come true.
Yeah, he in the beginning of this season, he did try to do his probably biggest swing at kind of achieving those dreams was this company called Entertainment 720. And it's called 720 because they'll travel around the world twice, 720 degrees, to make your dreams come true.
Let's play an ad that you and your partner in this company did to promote Entertainment 720. And in the commercial that you did, we won't see this, but like you're dancing, you're toasting with like these beautiful like brandy snifters, whatever they're called, and you're trying to look as hip as you possibly can.
I can't thank you guys enough. You made me millions of dollars.
Don't mention it. Take care.
Hey, Tom, who was that guy?
That was you, if you play your cards right. Hi, I'm Tom Haverford, one of the founders of Pawnee's hottest new company, Entertainment 720.
When Tom and I created Entertainment 720 way back in 2011, we had one simple goal in mind: create the premier multimedia entertainment production conglomerate in the world.
Mission accomplished. If you can call it entertainment, we'll handle it. Film production, television, radio, advertising,
record production, DJing. We will create YouTube videos that your kids actually watch. I will write your tweets and your Facebook statuses.
Club promotion, personal promotion, memorial videos for pet funerals, dogs, cats, fish, tiny horses, giant lizards, you name the animal.
Visual effects for raves, laser light shows, regular light shows.
I see Ansari from Parks and Recreation. It's so much fun to watch him trying to be as cool as his heroes are and always just being lame and embarrassing instead. Did you ever feel that way yourself when you were growing up?
I definitely relate to the frustration of being in a small town and wishing you were in somewhere bigger. I mean, I grew up in South Carolina in a very small town that had like 8,000 people. There was just nothing to do. Nothing cool was going on. But now I feel like with the internet and everything, you're so exposed to everything cool. And you can really get into a lot of cool stuff, even if you're just in, you know, South Carolina or in a small town. You can hear about, like, the coolest band in Brooklyn or whatever. Back when I was growing up, it wasn't like that, I don't think, as much. And I was definitely, like, frustrated. Like, it always just seemed like there was cooler stuff going on in bigger cities.
You're of Indian, the country of India ancestry. And
yes.
When you were growing up, there were probably not a lot of comics of South Asian ancestry to look to as role models. Did that matter to you?
I never saw an Indian person on TV unless it was like Gandhi or there was like a James Bond movie where he goes to India or like there's some show where they happen to go to India or they're showing a Quickie Mart guy. There was no one Indian on TV, like no one. When I did this sketch show on MTV called Human Giant around 2007, I joked around with the people at MTV. I was like, wow, it's pretty cool. I think I might be the first Indian person you've ever had on MTV. And I was half joking, but I think it may be true. Like, I can't think of ever seeing an Indian person on MTV. And I think it's really cool now. You can't avoid Indian people on TV. There's like one Indian person minimum on every like sitcom or drama. There's like some Indian guy in the office. It's really funny to me that that's the case. And even when I was coming up, even seeing like Mindy Kaling on The Office, it was great because you could point to her and be like, see, like she's a really funny character on that show and there's no jokes about her having an Indian accent or anything. It's just about her character and her personality. Even having that was like a great thing to point to. And I think now with me and Danny Pudi on Community and you know, a myriad of other people, I think it must be a little different to be a kid growing up that's Indian and seeing all these Indian people in the culture.
So somebody who knows your name now is President Obama, and he mentioned you at a fundraising event in New York in early March. He mentioned that you were there, You mentioned that you were backstage and that this was a particularly big deal because his daughter, Malia, is a huge fan of Parks and Recreation. So how did you end up being at that event with him, and how did he end up mentioning you?
As with a lot of things with me, it all goes back to food. I eat at that restaurant, ABC Kitchen, a lot. It's a restaurant in New York, and that's where this event was. And they came up to me, and they're like, hey, we're doing this event with President Obama. He's going to speak here, and we're wondering if you would want to host it or something. And I was like, yeah, sure, because you guys are going to be catering, and your food is delicious. And the Obama people contacted me, and they're like, would you want to do this? We think it's a great idea. You could speak. And I did it, and it was really fun. And I wrote this little speech for the event and made the speech. And then eventually the president spoke, and he mentioned me in the speech, and it just blew me away. Like, I still haven't quite comprehended how crazy it is that the president mentioned me in a speech. I still don't believe it. It's so crazy to me. And he came back backstage afterwards, and he talked to me for a while, and he mentioned that his daughter really loved Parks and Recreation, and he was just super nice and very cool.
That must have been really thrilling. I mean, how many comics get mentioned by a president?
Yeah, and he was just so nice. He was just so nice and, like, very charming. And, you know, obviously I'm not a supporter, but if Santorum had that same interaction with me, I'd be like, man, I might have to vote for Santorum. No.
There's a good deed that you did that I think few people know about. There was an article on Rolling Stone about violence against gay teenagers, and after you read it, you got in touch with the person who wrote the article and offered to do a fundraiser to raise money for an organization that works with gay teens, and you hosted a comedy benefit in L.A. on behalf of a Minnesota LGBT group. Why did you decide to do that?
I heard a YouTube clip from Howard Stern where he was talking about this article, and if you haven't read the article, you should really read it. It's about bullying, and particularly about this school in Minnesota where it was just really such a sad article. And I just read it, and I was like, man, is there, you know, it really affected me, and it really made me sad. Like, just thinking about these kids who were, these kids were just, like, getting put down by all these other kids in their school, and they seem like such brilliant kids, and it just really bummed me out that the bully kids were winning, that they were letting them ruin what was special about them, and it just didn't seem fair. It just seemed like these kids were...
Were you bullied as a kid?
I wasn't, you know? I think you would think I would be. It seemed like it'd be a really easy bully target, but... You know, obviously I was made fun of here and there, but I've said this, I think I even said it to you last time I talked to you, like, you know, it was probably on par with what a fat kid dealt with. It was not, like, serious racism where, like, kids were throwing rocks at me and harsh stuff like that, you read these stories and stuff and you read about, like, real torment, you know, like, real kids getting really tormented. I did not have that at all. But I guess I can relate to the idea of being different from everyone else, and I can relate to people telling you can't do something, or people making fun of you because you're different, or I've seen other kids make fun of other kids for having different interests or whatever. And when I read that story, it really ticked me off that the school allowed that to happen. Basically, the school district wasn't taking a stand. It really got bad, and several kids ended up taking their own lives. It was that bad. And one kid's mom started an organization called Justin's Gift. And the writer of the Rolling Stone article, I just emailed her and I was like, hey, I read this article and it's really affected me. I just feel like I want to do something. I'll gladly do a benefit. Like, it's really easy for me to, like, put on a show and raise some money. Like, who could I raise money for? What would be the best organization? And she referred me to the Justin's Gift. And so I was doing a show that weekend and it sold out and we gave that money. And then I put together another show with some other comedians that I'm friends with. And we charged more for that, and it sold out, and we raised, like, $15,000, like, just doing those two shows, and we gave it to them. And, you know, I was glad we were able to do those shows and do that, and I hope it helps those kids even a little bit, because, you know, it just really bummed me out hearing about what happened to those kids.
I think it's great that you did that. So you do a lot of tweeting, you have a lot of followers, and after the Trayvon Martin story, when Geraldo made his comment about how, you know, he shouldn't have been wearing a hoodie.
Yes.
You replied with a barbed tweet. And I'll ask you to tell us the radio-friendly version of what you said.
I think what I said was, it's really appropriate to say this any day, but today in particular, F you, Geraldo. And I tweeted that, and what I failed to realize is that now, whenever there's a big news story, news outlets will take things that people tweet and quote them as if that's like their statement on something. Obviously, if I was talking to like the Washington Post, that would not be my analysis of the event. No, I would have said something a little bit more nuanced. However, there was an article somewhere. I have it on my phone. I'll read it to you what they wrote. They wrote, the headline said something like, sorry, give me a second. I'll pull it up. It said, Geraldo Rivera says Trayvon Martin's hoodie made him a target, receives major backlash. The Fox News commentator says Martin's killer should be prosecuted, but the victim's attire put him at fault, too. Aziz Ansari responds, F you, Geraldo. I love that that was in the sub-headline for that article. Which, in that case, you know, I don't like people quoting me, you know, from my Twitter in like a serious news article. But in that case, it was so funny to me that I approve.
Aziz Ansari, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Aziz Ansari co-stars on Parks and Recreation. His new comedy special, Dangerously Delicious, is available exclusively on his website. You'll find a link to it on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback, angieslist.com. From DreamWorks Pictures and Touchstone Home Entertainment with War Horse, from director Steven Spielberg, on Blu-ray April 3rd, rated PG-13. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
I hear music when I look at you.
That's Doris Day. I thought I'd never get to talk with her, but coming up, we have a rare interview with her in celebration of her birthday. She turns 88 tomorrow. TCM is showing many of her films this month. We'll talk about how she started and ended her music and movie career.
Deep in my heart, I hear it play. I feel it start. Then melt away. I hear music when I touch your hand. A beautiful melody from some enchanted land. Down deep in my heart, I hear it say, is this the day?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
What have you accomplished? Can you produce a picture? Have you done one successful thing on your own? Just who do you think you are?
Whoever I am, kiddo, I'm what makes you tick.
That's Doris Day having it out with James Cagney in the 1955 film Love Me or Leave Me, one of the four Doris Day films TCM has just released in a new DVD box set in celebration of her 88th birthday, which is tomorrow. TCM has also just released a 2-CD set of her recordings, and she's TCM's Star of the Month, which means they'll be showing her movies in primetime tonight through Friday night this week, a total of 28 films. I'm thrilled to be able to celebrate Doris Day's birthday with an interview that I just recorded with her. Before we hear it, and before I tell you why I love her singing, let me tell you why, when I was young, I didn't. This is the reason.
Hey, Sera, Sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see. Que Sera, Sera, what will be.
Although that song is from a Doris Day movie I like, Alfred Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much, I hadn't yet seen the film when the song played constantly on my parents' radio station for years, the station they tortured me with when what I wanted to hear was rock and roll. Day's romantic comedies of the 60s also seemed like they were for my parents, not for me. Then I grew up and started listening to jazz and jazz singers, and I heard some of Doris Day's recordings with just a pianist or trio. Her voice is so beautiful. You'll hear what I mean on this 1962 track with Andre Previn that's included on the new TCM CD reissue.
Fools rush in where angels fear to tread, and so I come to you, my love. My heart above my head, though I see the danger there, if there's a chance for me, then I don't care.
So the next step for me was going back and watching her early movies and finding songs like this one with the Paige Kavanaugh Trio from her first film, Romance on the High Seas, released in 1948. This movie is also included in the TCM DVD box.
It's you or no one for me, I'm sure of this. Each time we kiss,
ladies in love.
You are still the one. Please.
The lady said please.
Don't say no to my please.
Pretty good, right? In 1954, Doris Day starred opposite Frank Sinatra in the film Young at Heart. He played a songwriter, and at the end of the film, they duet on the song his character writes. And if you're a fan of Day and Sinatra, watching and hearing them together is something special.
Yes, and because of you, my love, my wishful dreams came true, my love.
In my uncertain heart, I am only certain of.
So I've told you some of the reasons why I love Doris Day. I guess everyone who loves her has their own reasons, and when I say everyone, I mean lots of people. Doris Day is the biggest female box office star in Hollywood history. She started singing in big bands when she was a teenager, made her first film when she was 24, and after making about 40 movies, walked away from that part of her life in 1968. After that, her mission was rescuing and caring for animals. Doris Day ended her public life many years ago. We phoned her at her home in California. Doris Day, welcome to Fresh Air. I know you rarely give interviews, so let me start by saying that even if we only get to speak for a few moments, I'm so excited that I get to wish you a happy birthday and tell you how much your work means to me. When I grew up, your movies were very popular, but I kind of thought of them as my parents' generation, likewise with the recordings. But when I started making my own taste, I fell in love with your early recordings, and that led me to your movies, your early movies, your later movies, and I just love your work.
Thank you so much. I can't believe it.
Now,
you're so sweet to say all those nice things. Ugh.
I have to say, your voice still sounds like Doris Day's voice.
Does it?
Yeah.
Well, that's good, huh?
I'm wondering, when you gave up acting and performing, your last movie was in 68, your last TV, I think, was in 73, and you've been avoiding the public eye and keeping photographers away, but did you still enjoy singing, even if it was just around the house?
Oh, I love singing. But I had bronchitis, which I've never had before in my life, and only when I moved here. And it was very, very, very rough on me. And I think that my voice is, it seems that it's different to me, and it makes me feel terrible because I love to sing so much. And sometimes I sing around the house. Sometimes I start singing, and it sounds like me. And I feel, so good about that. And sometimes it doesn't, because the air up here is so different than when I was in Los Angeles. It's totally different.
When did you get the bronchitis?
Oh, it was a few years ago.
And where are you exactly?
I'm in Carmel. I'm in the Carmel Valley.
Oh, I know that area. Yeah, and it could get kind of chilly and foggy.
Mm-hmm. Sure does.
So, did singing always feel more pure to you? I always think, when you're in a movie, you're playing a part. But when I hear you singing, I just feel like that is you. That is like just cutting to your essence. There's something so beautiful and also naked about it. I don't feel like you're playing a character. Do you know what I'm saying? I feel like I'm hearing your essence.
Well, that sounds good to me.
But did you feel different as a singer than as an actress?
No, not at all. I just, I was put in a film. I had never acted, and then I discovered that I would be singing in that first film. And it was just natural. It just came so natural.
And that was Romance on the High Seas.
Yes.
My guest is Doris Day. Tomorrow is her 88th birthday. TCM is showing her movies every night this week, and there's a new 4-DVD box set of her films and a 2-CD set of recordings curated by her. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded last week with Doris Day. We called her at her home in California. Tomorrow is her 88th birthday, and in celebration, TCM is showing her movies every weekday night this week. So a lot of people may already know this story, but when you were a teenager and Paramount offered to bring you from your home in Cincinnati to Hollywood, you had a going-away party, and on the way home, the car you were in was hit by a train and one of your legs was shattered. And that ruined what your dream was at the time, which was to be a dancer. And it's only after that you discovered you could sing. And when I hear that story, I think, how could Doris Day possibly have known that she couldn't sing until until she was a teenager and laid up after this accident?
When that accident happened, I was a dancer with a boy partner. I was very young, but we used to sing together, and then we would dance. So I was used to singing, but then when that accident happened, it was a bad thing for my leg was hurt badly, and my right foot, so much so that I couldn't walk, and I had to lie down. And I was just lying down all the time, and a couple of years went by, because the I hate to go into all of this. It must be boring.
No.
The bones in my right leg from the knee down were not healing. And so that went on for a few years, and I did nothing but just lie there because they had to wait until the bone in the bones would come together.
Did that give you a sense of patience or anxiety? I mean, you must have been really nervous about healing at the same time. Only patience can see you through something like that.
Well, my mother didn't go into the details about the bones not knitting. She just said, you know, we have to take our time with this, and you understand that. And I said, sure, whatever has to be will be. And that sounds like case.
It sure does. I was going to point that out.
No, but I didn't mind. I wasn't upset, and I wasn't anxious to get out of bed. I knew that I had to lie there and be quiet. And suddenly it pulled together, and I was able to stand. And then before too long, I was singing with a band in Cincinnati at the age of 16. But the man who brought his band into the place was well-known in Cincinnati and loved by everybody. And my mother told him about 16, and she said that she's not supposed to be singing anywhere and getting paid at 16. And he said, we'll put a pretty gown on her, we're going to fix her hair really beautiful, and she's going to sing the way I like her to sing. And then we go on from there, and she's 18.
Uh-huh. So you had to lie a little bit.
Oh, he did. He did it. I kept that, the 2 years older, for years. It was really funny. I was always 2 years older than I really was. And so then, you know, as the years go on, and my mother said to me, you know what? She said, it just occurred to me, you've been whatever the number was that she talked about. She said, maybe like 30. She said, you know what? You're not really 30. You're 28. And I looked at her and I said, oh, my gosh, I forgot all about that. We both did.
So what birthday are we actually celebrating now?
88.
Okay, so that's the real number. Okay. So you became famous for your romantic comedies in the 50s and 60s, but there was this image of you that became formed that the characters you played were kind of, you know, like bland and a little stereotyped or something. But really, when you look at the roles you played, like you're a working woman, and you're an independent, single working woman in some of those like really classic films, you know, like in Pillow Talk in 1959 with Rock Hudson. You're an independent interior decorator in Lover Come Back to Me, 1961 with Rock Hudson. You worked in the advertising industry in Touch of Mink with Cary Grant, 1962. You're a career woman. So, you know, you're actually playing these independent working women.
That's what I was. For real.
For real, right. For real, you must have been pretty tough, actually.
Oh, I don't know.
No?
I don't know about being tough. But what we were doing was something that I was just loving. You know, I just loved my work, and whatever they wanted me to do, I wanted to do.
Did you get the sense that there was this, like, image of who Doris Day was that was sometimes not really who either your characters were or who you were?
No. No, I didn't. I just did what it wanted me to do. I didn't compare, in other words, and say, oh, God, I'm not like that. Whatever, when I read the script, the words told me what I was. And I never had a problem with that. I played me doing that.
Is that the way you saw it, playing yourself, but as somebody else?
Playing myself, no matter what it was.
Playing yourself as if you were in that position of your character.
That's right. It had to be done like that. I had to say things like that. It was fine.
What was the biggest stretch for you, the character most unlike you?
Oh, they were all different. I didn't feel different in any of them, even though they were different. I loved, you know, being married, and I loved not being married, but working on it. And doing what I was supposed to do and be. That's the way I worked.
So you left the movies after 1968. Your last film with Six, You Get Egg Roll, and it was the same year that your husband of the time died. Why did you leave movies then?
I don't know. I thought that I had done all the different things, and I loved doing them. And then I had a feeling of just quieting down, and I came out to Carmel, and it was so nice. You know, and I have so many doggies. And I thought, this would really be nice to get out of Los Angeles because it was changing down there quickly, and it wasn't good. And so I came up, and we redid a home, and I just moved in, and that was it. And to be in films, when I think about that, then I thought I should have stayed because I loved that so much. But there were all kinds of new people coming up, and I thought, I've done mine. I've had a great time, so now it's their turn. And that's the way I felt.
But it didn't have to be like one or the other. You could have lived in Carmel and still made movies, maybe fewer movies, but you could have.
Yeah, I could have, but I have so many dogs that I love dearly, and I was working and helping the SPCA. I rented a place that I could have dogs, not in my house. I rented a big place, and I was able to have the SPCA every end of the week bring many, many dogs to me. They all were in nice places, clean, everything was fine. I took good care of them, and so many people called, darling ladies came and said, I want to help you. I'll work for nothing. I love dogs, too, and cats. And I said, well, that's great. And so that's what I've started to do right away. And I just loved it. I placed dogs with wonderful people and lovely homes, and the dogs were just precious. And then one day, a woman came out where we always did the work and said that you're to get off the property. Who's Doris Day here? You're out of here in 2 weeks. It was just rude, and we managed to get out. And I kept all the dogs that I had there.
Where? Where did you keep them?
In my house.
Oh, God. Oh, gosh.
I have a big, big house.
How many dogs was that?
Oh, at one about 30.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding?
No. And I kept them.
You kept them all?
Yep.
30?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a big, big house here.
How big was it?
Oh, big.
Like how many rooms?
Oh, my gosh. Three upstairs, four upstairs, so downstairs, a lot of rooms.
Okay.
It's so difficult. And then I had my own area in another spot. It was connected, of course, and that was just perfect for me. Everything was right. It was good. I could have as many dogs as I wanted, and, oh, I kept them until they went to heaven.
Wow, you really lived with a lot of dogs for a long time.
Well, see, there was another area of the house, and they had a big run. They had a huge area to play. They were just fabulous, and I kept them all.
So how many animals do you live with now?
Six.
I would have thought that was a lot. Now it seems like nothing.
Well, I can, when I...
Are they dogs or any of them cats?
Oh, yes, cats, too. Lots of cats.
How many cats?
Oh, God, maybe 10.
Now?
But I have lots of room. Oh, yeah, and they're in a special area in the house. They have an outdoor area. It's closed. They can't get out. But the ceiling is all glass, and they look up there, and they see the trees, and when it rains, they love it. And it's perfect for them.
My guest is Doris Day. Tomorrow is her 88th birthday. TCM is showing her movies every night this week, and there's a new 4-DVD box set of her films and a 2-CD set of her recordings that she curated herself. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded last week with Doris Day. We called her at her home in California. Tomorrow is her 88th birthday, and in celebration, TCM is showing her movies every weekday night this week. So I want to confess something to you, which is when I was growing up, the first real big hit of yours that I knew was Que Sera Sera, which you sing in The Man Who Knew Too Much, the Alfred Hitchcock film. And so my confession is that I didn't like it.
I didn't either.
That's what I read, that you didn't like it either and you didn't want... So I was so happy to read that. Tell me why you didn't like it.
Well, the first time that somebody told me it was going to be in that movie, I thought, why? Because the movie, you know, how horrible it was toward the ending when our boy was kidnapped. And I didn't think that there was a place to put that song. And I heard the song before I knew what the story was completely. But then they tell me that that's going to be in the movie. I thought, why?
And for anybody who doesn't know the song, the lyric is, Que sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see, Que sera, sera.
Yeah, and I thought, I'm not crazy about that. Where are they going to put it? For what? Is it when I put him in bed sometime and I sing that to him or something? I did that in another film, and I thought maybe that's what it's going to be, and I didn't think it was a good song.
And just standing on its own as a song, did you like it?
No, it isn't the kind of song that I like to sing.
So how did you feel about that being, there's probably a number one hit, and yet you didn't really like it very much?
Well, I thought that was wonderful because I think it became that because of children.
Mm-hmm.
And then I understood it because it was for the child, for our child in the movie.
Right.
And so then I, you know, I realized, so maybe it isn't a favorite song of mine, but people loved it, and kids loved it, and it was perfect for the film. So, you know, I can't say that it's a favorite song of mine that I think is fabulous, but boy, it sure did something. It came out, and it was loved.
What is a favorite song of yours?
Oh, I have too many.
Okay.
Oh, my God. I love to sing love songs. And I like to sing others, too. But there are so many that I love. I just really love them, and I love singing them.
So I guess I just want to say thank you. Thank you for the interview. Thank you even more for your movies and your music. I'm so happy that I've had the chance to talk with you because I know how little of this you do.
I'm happy that I had a chance to talk to you too, Terry. And it is Terry, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Isn't that funny?
Oh, because that's your son's name. Yeah.
You're really good at what you do.
Oh, thank you.
And I enjoyed it a lot. I really did.
Oh, that makes me so happy. Thank you.
And it's so nice to say hello to you and to know you.
Thank you. Thank you. I wish you good health.
And I wish you good health.
Thank you.
And I send my love to you.
Doris Day spoke to us from her home in Carmel, California. Tomorrow is her 88th birthday. TCM is showing her movies every weekday night this week, and TCM has teamed up with Sony Masterworks and Warner Home Video to release a 4-movie DVD package and a double CD set curated by Doris Day, collecting 31 songs. Happy birthday, Doris Day. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Imagination is funny. It makes a cloudy day.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from PBS, exploring the history and legacy of the Grand Coulee Dam on American Experience tomorrow on PBS. Local times may vary. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to increase Americans' understanding of Muslim cultures through the arts and media. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Peter Beinart talks about his new book, The Crisis of Zionism. He supports Israel, but thinks the Jewish settlements in the West Bank are compromising Israel's commitment to democracy. He's proposed a boycott of goods made in those Jewish settlements. We'll get a response from Gary Rosenblatt, editor and publisher of The Jewish Week of New York. Join us.